Welcome to Talent Hub Talk. I'm Ben Duncombe, and on this podcast, I will be interviewing prominent and inspirational figures from both the local ANZ and global Salesforce Ohana. In today's episode, I'm joined by Anoop Jadhav. Anoop is a Salesforce program architect working for Salesforce in the UK. And through this episode, we look back at what first attracted him to a career in IT and studying computer science. We look at his early career, what he did as an engineer in the early days, and how he rated himself as a developer. We also look at what first attracted him into the Salesforce ecosystem and the roles that he initially played. We focus then on Anoop's career in engineering and moving into the architect space, but then also moving into an engineering manager position, why he took that move, and ultimately what he got from that experience and how he benefited. We really focus in on how he learned to manage people, especially developers, and what he got from being an engineering manager that he perhaps would have not have got if he stayed in the architecture space. We then look at the industry experience that Anoop has and his specialization for insurance, and also why he has chosen to be an industry specialist and how he sees the future of Salesforce specializations evolving potentially and including more industry specializations. So yeah, really interesting episode. I think people can take a lot from this episode, whether you're a developer coming through, someone that's looking to move from development into architecture or even into people management, or even someone that's looking at potentially being an industry expert and looking for validation as to why that potentially is a good route for your future career. So I hope you enjoy the episode. And if you do, please do subscribe for future episodes that are coming through. So Anoop, thanks so much for joining us. A nice early start for you in London. So thank you for being flexible and jumping on the call nice and early.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. We've got a lot to jump through. I always start looking backwards to find out a bit more about you and how you've got to where you are today. So if we look at kind of your earlier career, but really what attracted you to a career in IT and ultimately at that point studying computer science, what was that kind of driver for you?
Cool. Yeah. I mean, if I'm being honest, so I was raised in an environment, I grew up in India, where all my friends thought that if you became an engineer or a doctor, you know, like an MD, a medical doctor, you're set for life. So given the huge supply of employable talent in India and the competition for jobs, becoming a specialist like computer science engineer seemed like a safe proposition. If it was up to me, I'd have become a mathematician. And I spent my life thinking about, you know, abstract concepts. As it turns out, you know, computer science overlaps with logic, and my career as a programmer and now as an architect allows me to think about abstract concepts all day. So I can't really complain. So yeah, at university, I majored in computer science and learned C, C++. And I hate to admit it, Pascal as well. I don't know if you know this.
I've heard language, of it, yeah.
But yeah, it's very old school. But yeah, I took to programming very quickly. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed solving problems, building logic, business logic, and here I am.
Sure. When you left study and moved into the real world of IT and doing kind of your role day to day, what did the first kind of engineering roles that you took on look like? What were you kind of focusing on and what problems were you solving?
So my first job was with a company called Wipro Technologies. It is the third largest services company in India after Tata Consultancy and Infosys. So I trained as a Java engineer, and my first role was a junior software developer. I remember it was a banking client at Wipro. The key thing was I had the opportunity and the good luck to work with some of the most talented people at Wipro who showed me the ropes and taught me how to navigate the corporate world. I was a decent developer, I'd say. I was not a 10x, but not a 2x either. I usually learn by doing things. So I'd read something, but I'll immediately forget all about it if I don't use that knowledge. So I learned by doing. And so when I became a software engineer, I was lucky enough to have a lot of good books out there, like Code Complete, The Mythical Man Month, Clean Code, etc., where people before me had done the hard work of thinking and coming up with good concepts. And the team that I worked with encouraged reading these books and implementing those best practices at work. So very early on, I built the discipline to try and do the right thing where possible. You're always against project deadlines and budgets and all that stuff, but within those constraints, try and do the right thing rather than build up technical debt in the future.
Sure. So I've got two questions to come out of your response then. Is there such thing as a 10x developer, and do they exist?
That's a very controversial question. I have an opinion and a view. Whether it's true or not is, I think, you know, we'll see. Software development is very much a, it's still a very new profession compared to some of the other professions that we have in the world. And one of the professions we'll talk about being insurance, right? So insurance brokers, and they've been around for a while. But software development is a relatively new profession. Even though we call it software engineering, it is not the same as engineering, where you have fixed rules and you can figure everything out up front. And you have to, you know, if you're building a bridge, which is going to carry traffic all day long, you have to think through all of the factors, take all those factors into consideration, and design something that will outlast you, right? Software is not like that. Building software, even though we call it engineering, there is some overlap with engineering design principles. Software is different. In software world, you can change your mind, and users or the customers usually do, and you have to respond to that. Keeping that in mind, you have to also try and follow the best practices, but also software evolves, the technology, the platform constantly evolves, so you have to stay on top of things. You know, unlike engineering, where the principles have been the same for generations, in software, you have a new framework every other day, especially in the JavaScript world. You know, before you blink, there are 10 new frameworks out there. So you have to stay on top of these things. You have to learn what's the latest, the best. And it's difficult. So building software is difficult. So to answer your question, are there 10x developers? My view is yes. But I also think of 10x in a different way. So they're not just technically good. They're also good at adapting to changes within their platform. So then they're not stuck using a language that's 10 years old. They understand and have that sense of, okay, this is the best solution for this problem. They're able to do trade-offs between doing it fast versus doing it right, sure, kind of thing. And this is a very important trade-off. So they do exist. These are people who, if you give them a task, will do that task 10 times faster than a normal developer. But I also don't think it's not a binary thing. It's not like you have 10x and then you have 1x. I think if people are on the spectrum, and sometimes people actually move within that spectrum as well. You know, so you might be 10x with JavaScript, but you might, if a new technology comes up, you might then be 2x in that, because you didn't get the opportunity to either learn, or you weren't bothered to learn that because your career has moved on, right? So it's a qualified yes. I do believe that they exist.
Sure. And then my other question, because you said that, you know, you were lucky to have some really great people around you that kind of helped guide you on the right path and make sure that you were doing the right things. And so what was it that you think those people saw in you? Because, like, it's really important for junior developers or people that are starting out to have those mentors and have people around them to learn from. But you said you weren't a 10x, you weren't a 2x, you were somewhere in between. So it wasn't that, you know, you were immediately the most amazing developer or 10x developer in your word. So what did you bring to the role that someone that was more senior would say, you know what, I'm going to mentor this person and give them my knowledge? Because I think it's important for people to understand what do you have to bring, if it's not just the technical knowledge, to be given that kind of platform and support?
I think that the most important thing you have to bring to the table is enthusiasm for work. So if when you turn up for work, you have to kind of, even if it's not your job, you should show interest in, okay, how are you doing this? Show me, rather than telling me, show me how would I do this? You know, because it's very easy for a senior person to solve the problem themselves rather than letting someone else do it. So I had the tendency of, okay, this thing, I don't understand it, but it only means that I don't know the rules of how to do certain things. And I think I always have that attitude of, this is a new thing for me. You need to bring the growth mindset to the table along with enthusiasm. With the growth mindset, you would think, I don't know how to solve a certain thing because it's new to me, but I can learn this. And it was very apparent that I was always eager to learn, eager to understand how things worked. And I believe that they saw that in me, and that's why they decided to mentor me in a sense. Back then, I didn't even officially know the world of mentoring and all that. I just fell into it. But now, if I see someone new, junior, that comes my way and they show that same kind of growth mindset and enthusiasm, I try and return the favor by telling them or guiding them to say, okay, you might want to consider this, read this book, because the knowledge now, even though the profession is new and evolving, there are some best practices that are universal in principle that people have put it out there. You just have to go out looking, you know, but there is a lot of information, you know, there's a lot of blog posts and stuff, but it's out there. And a mentor's job is to filter that information and shape that guidance that suits that particular person. Sure. And I was lucky to have those people around me too who gave me that filtered guidance.
Yeah, that's great. I think that's a really important lesson for people coming through. Like, you have to kind of earn the respect of mentors as well. You don't just naturally, like, a mentor isn't someone that has to give you their time. You have to kind of earn it by having bringing the right things to the table. So it's interesting. So how did you find Salesforce and why were you initially interested or attracted to the Salesforce ecosystem?
So I kind of stumbled into this ecosystem. So I was working as a Java developer for a billing company here in Reading back in 2008. And they were using Salesforce as a CRM application. And this was around the time when Salesforce launched the Force.com platform. So I was asked to take the first ever Dev 401 course in London in order to pick up the skills. It was relatively easy for me to pick up Apex and Visual Force because they were very similar to Java and Java server faces. So I fell in love with the ease of building applications quickly on the platform. And that, you know, that to answer your question, why Salesforce? It was just, I could see how easy it was to build complex applications using config and code when needed. Because having worked in Java and also a bit in .NET world, I've seen the complexity of building a full-fledged application from scratch. And I still remember thinking how undemanding and painless it was to build a moderately complex application on the Force.com platform. So I was in the right place, right time as well. So, you know, it was Force.com was launched and I was doing Java. So it was easy to pick and pivot my career to Salesforce/Force.com.
Sure. So it's interesting because and we'll go into the different roles you've played over the years, but you've been an engineer, you've been an engineering manager, you've been an architect, and you've gone between the roles that typically we see a lot of the time people want to go from engineering to architecture. And in my opinion, it's kind of like a race to get there in the ecosystem, right? People want that title. They're striving to be an architect and sometimes it's kind of running before they can walk in the learning the lessons of everything they need to know to own that title. So how did you make that transition back when you made that move from engineer to architect? And why was that a role that you wanted to take on?
So it was a typical progression for me, to be honest. So I worked my way. So I joined. And again, this was because I was involved in a platform or a technology that was evolving or, you know, that was very, very new. I was kind of forced to be an individual contributor first, understand, make mistakes, learn the best practices, in some places define the best practices. You know, I still remember the first trigger code I wrote and it was horrible. It was not bulkified or anything because back then we were like, okay, let's build this fast, knowing what we know. Obviously, those best practices evolved. So I learned to be an individual contributor, to be an engineer. Then I worked my way to be a senior developer. Then the tech lead opportunity came my way. Sometimes, you know, again, this is all about being in the right place, right time. Sometimes you have to have that opportunity and then you have to have the willingness to take on that role. So I became a tech lead and we'll talk about being an engineering manager because becoming a tech lead is learning a different set of skills than being an individual contributing and solving the problem yourselves. And then after that, I became a solution design lead. And then, you know, eventually I went to technical architecture. So for me, I couldn't, even if I wanted to get that next title, I couldn't do that because my career was progressing at the same pace as Force.com was evolving. The reason people want to, and this is, I feel that this is this is more of a problem in the Salesforce ecosystem than elsewhere because you get the confidence of building applications early on and you mistake that confidence with you can build anything. And the reason you want to get that architect title, and you know, in this case, there is a demand and supply problem, and that's to blame as well, is once you get the architect title, you can ask for more pay and all of that. But you don't have the experience. So if your experience is only building a 10-story building, an architect could be involved in building a skyscraper, and you probably don't have the know-how or the knowledge to understand what goes into building a skyscraper versus a 5 or 10 story building, right? But people say, oh, it was so easy to build that building. I can do this. So I'll just put a slab architect on my resume, put my CV out there, get a job. And then you see them struggle. Sometimes people, you know, they wing it. They learn by doing it. They make mistakes. They get away by making those mistakes, but they learn on the job. But others never realize that they are not empowered or they don't have the knowledge to build a complex architecture that touches 5 different systems where there are different trade-offs that you have to consider. And you also see this problem when people prematurely try to take the CTA exam, wherein, again, but right now Celsius is fixing this problem by adding a number of prerequisites before that CTA exam. But, you know, you have to application architect and all of that before. Even then, you might not be ready for the board exam. And I think the main reason for that is that final board exam relies on 2 things. It relies on specific preparation that you need to do. And so you definitely need people who have been through that process to train you. But also it depends on your broader experience. You can't wing that. You know, if you don't have that view of or bigger picture of how these different solutions come together to solve a problem, then you'll be in trouble and then you'll fail because then you'll realize, oh, okay, you didn't have that knowledge. But most people don't find out because they don't take the CTA exam. They just put the architect title, get that job, and then they realize, okay, there's more to it than they thought.
And the thing that interests me about your background is that you went from architect to then into an engineering manager role, which isn't a move that we see that often in the ecosystem because, yeah, not going into a management role from an architecture role kind of goes against everything that we see in terms of progression to CTA, right? And that's kind of the driver for a lot of architects in the market. So what was it about that role that attracted you back into engineering, core engineering and management? And what did you learn from that experience?
So, yeah, so I've always been an engineer, so I always continue to. So for me, I see myself as a software engineer rather than just a specific Salesforce expert. And, you know, if today it's Salesforce, 10 years from now, it will be a different technology or whatever. So I was not thinking about it as, okay, now I'm an architect, I have to now go for the CTA path and do that. For me, yes, of course, at some point, I will probably take the CTA exam, but that doesn't preclude me from trying out different roles and acquiring different skills. The reason I took up the engineering manager role is because I enjoyed being a tech lead. It was a interesting skill to develop. You know, people management skills is very different from being an individual contributor. Your focus shifts from how do I solve this problem to how do I help and support my team solve this problem? And you multiply your impact by this way. So when I became a tech lead and when I consciously forced myself to step away from coding and focus more on building and nurturing a team and helping them achieve their goals and seeing how much more impact I was having at that level, that gave me a taste of what you can achieve by being in a leadership position or management position. So when the engineering manager role came up, where I had a broader remit to be involved in strategy and architecture and managing people. So it ticked all 3 boxes for me. I took up that role.
Yeah. You kind of learned that you can add value in more ways than just being an individual contributor and spreading your knowledge across a team. How do you manage developers?
How do you manage developers? Not easily. So I think managing developers or managing anybody is a skill that not everybody has. I didn't have it, certainly. I had to learn those skills. And again, like everything else, I turned to literature and books out there on how to do this. So that's where I picked up nuggets of wisdom on how to do this right or try to do it right as well. The key to management is to shift that focus from trying to solve the problem yourself to helping the team solve the problem. And it's very difficult if you've been a developer or even an architect, because you know you have more control over what the solution looks like versus handing that control over to a team and helping them solve it. So you have to build that skill. If you don't do it, and if you kind of try and solve those problems yourself, you might be solving the technical problems, but you might end up having cultural and people problems down the line where the morale is low and the people are not giving the 100%. And that will then have a negative impact on how much value you can add. You know, the whole point of being a leader or a manager is to multiply your impact. If you keep solving the problems for them, or if you get involved in low-level details or implementation stuff, then you won't give the team the opportunity to grow and multiply
that. Is it hard, though, to do that? Because I imagine, like, coming from a strong engineering background, and you know, you're probably looking at these problems thinking, I can solve that very quickly. Like you said, when we discussed mentoring at the beginning, you were saying, look, the senior people can solve the problem quickly. You must have been sat there in this engineering manager role thinking, you know, I can solve this problem and I really want to, but I need to step back.
Yeah, I think for two reasons you think that. First is hubris and ego, and you know you think that you know it all. The second reason is there is an information asymmetry between managers and people implementing this. So when you're a manager, you're involved in more broader discussions, and you have that information that you may or may not communicate downstream. So that's why you feel that. Was it hard for me initially? Yes. Again, it was, but then I knew that I have to consciously learn the skills to manage people. It's not something I'm going to pick up on the job, which some of it I did, but you can't just go from being a developer to a tech lead or a manager and keep doing what you were doing before. You have to start thinking of, in some ways, it's slightly easier to be a developer because all you have to do is tell the platform to do your bidding than trying to get people to do your bidding in a way, because people are emotional, people have their view, and you know they have all sorts of problems. And it's, for me at least, learning that skill to manage people, showing them the ropes, you know, mentoring them was more satisfying and enjoyable than trying to build it all myself. And that's why it was slightly easier for me than what it would have been. So it's an attitude shift as well. So if you don't have that attitude shift, if you just say, oh, managing people is so tough and people are messy and blah, 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 then you'll probably never succeed. So you have to shift that attitude, shift that focus, and learn from people who've come before you, right? There are lots of articles out there that describe how to go from being a software developer to a tech lead or an engineering manager. Heed to that advice. You will fail. I failed multiple times, but you learn from it and you rinse and repeat. Sure. You try again.
So how, again, this is touching on the role of a developer, and we have a lot of developers that listen to our podcast. So how have you seen the role of a developer change over the years? Because it's a broader skill set now than perhaps when you first started doing your 401 course back in 2008. You know, now we're really starting to see CI/CD become something that Salesforce teams are talking about, and how delivery is done is now a hot topic on Salesforce projects. Was that something that you were really kind of conscious of back then, or is it now, is the role becoming more of a software engineering role than it ever was before in the Salesforce ecosystem?
Yes, the short answer is yes. So when we started, one of the things that I didn't like was how we were deploying artifacts from one environment to another, but also we didn't have a lot of options back then, right? So we had the force.com and Ant migration tool, so which was very similar to how Java folks did deployment, but it was limited because it didn't support all of the metadata. And then we had chain sets, or you just did manual deployment. So it was easier back then, but then the scope of the problems being solved by Salesforce was also smaller initially, and that has changed over time. You have a massive ecosystem, a lot of customers using Salesforce, doing really large transformation projects on the platform. And so to support that kind of capability, you do need a more robust deployment strategy. And you can't just rely on having a single, and also the teams were smaller as well. But now the teams working on projects are larger, and that requires a different strategy of being able to deploy multiple projects at the same time, or multiple pieces of work at the same time without stepping on each other's toes. And that's what led to the whole SFDX model that's coming up. So my view is, you're right, the developer's role has changed, but in more than one ways. Again, back then, there was a clear differentiation between devs and admins. you know, the devs did Apex Visual Force and then Lightning Components, but an admins did just the point and click. They had Process Builder and stuff. But now you have Flow, which is very advanced now. The whole screen flows and flow technology has advanced a lot. And you can do a lot of things with Flow that you could have done with Apex. Obviously, you would still use Apex for really complex batch processing and some complex logic. But as a developer or admins, you have to start thinking about, if you're using Flow, then you have to think about it like a developer would, you know, think about all the considerations. You can't just say it's point and click, so you don't have to worry about the long-term impact of what you're building. So you have to start thinking about that. So those boundaries are a bit blurred. So that's one aspect of how that role has changed. The second thing that has changed is the deployment. The teams have grown bigger, and that has led to these new tools being implemented to make deployment easier. It's still painful. The, you know, developers need to now know a number of different things, like how to use Git properly, how to use SFDX properly. If they are not using SFDX, if they're using one of these gear set or Copado or whatever, they have to learn that as well. But what you're also seeing is specialization. So unless you are a developer in a small team, you don't have to know everything. You know, you can focus on building flows, building LWC components, and there would be another person responsible for managing the pipeline. As long as you follow the process of committing to the Git repository properly, then you don't have to worry about how that pipeline deploys things, right? We're not there yet, but that's where you want to get to. And the third thing that we haven't talked about is testing, right? So testing, again, is a hot topic where you could say that if you're working on big projects, how much testing a developer needs to do? Should they be writing scripts more than just unit tests and integration tests? Or is that a role for testers? And probably, you know, the answer is a bit of both. You probably also need test engineers who can write automated tests for the applications being built, because it's almost impossible now for large projects where manual testing can scale the same way that the developers want them to be. If you want to develop quickly, if you want to do weekly releases, manual testing is not the answer. So you need test engineers or tools that will help you automate a lot of this testing, because unit tests will cover only a little bit, only the Apex code part of it. But then there's so much more to the testing. You have smoke testing, UI testing, integration testing, and the developers or the development team needs to cater for that.
Yeah, it's interesting because like 6 years ago when I started recruiting in the Salesforce space, it was even then, I mean, we're not talking like tens of years back, but there's a Salesforce developer, Salesforce functional consultant, Salesforce admin, project manager, but the developer role was like, it was always called developer. And now we're seeing these Salesforce engineer roles. And I think it's because of the kind of companies that are now using Salesforce, like they're the fintechs, the insurance techs, the real estate techs, and they've got big engineering teams and they're hiring for engineers, not just people that know Apex. And it's often exactly. The hardest roles to fill for me is when someone comes to me and says, we need a Salesforce engineer, and they need to know branching, and they need to know X, and they need to know Y. And you're like, great, but the market hasn't really kept up with this in the sense that we're still seeing people that just know Salesforce.
Yeah, and I think the best engineers are the ones who have prior experience in other programming languages or building applications in other programming languages. So if they come from Java, .NET background, then they're probably exposed to things like, you know, how to do this properly using Git, the deployment pipelines and all of that stuff. And then if they are then trained up to be Salesforce engineers, they take to that more easily than people who've never done anything else than just Salesforce, because then they have to learn these ancillary skills of, you know, Git, testing.
You've worked in end user companies, you've worked in consulting companies, you obviously now work for Salesforce, but if we focus on the differences between consulting and end user, what do you think are the benefits of each?
So the benefit of being a consultant is the breadth of experience and exposure to problems that you get. So unless you're a specialist from the beginning, you will get to work in different sectors and domains and probably with clients of all shapes and sizes, right? And that's exciting, especially if you're young and keen to explore opportunities in various industries. But as you grow older, at least in my view, you would do well to specialize. And sometimes it's natural. And other times you make a conscious choice to pick an industry and deepen your domain expertise in that. And that you can do well if you're working with a specific end customer within that industry. So one of the downsides of being a consultant is that you get the responsibility without the autonomy of making some strategic decisions, or at least that's what I've seen, that will have an impact on the outcome of your work, right? So you have the responsibility, but you don't have the autonomy when you're a consultant. But when you're working for the end client, you know, especially for if you're in a senior role, you have both the autonomy and the accountability to make the right choices, and also to influence the stakeholders. And
probably, and with that comes responsibility, right? And that's you need to be ready for that responsibility, yep. and have the knowledge and expertise to make those decisions.
Yep, indeed. And in our world, I think, when I say in our world, in the Salesforce world, we obviously have a better salaries on the consultancy side because there's more demand. But at the same time, it all depends on what you want to do and where your passions lie. You know, there are some people who really like being a generalist in terms of technology and the projects that they do, and they really enjoy being consultants because that kind of gets them to work on different things. But if you decide to specialize in a specific industry, then you should definitely consider working for an end customer to get more credibility as well. So, you know, we'll talk about insurance in a bit, but if you want to be credible within the insurance domain, and then you have to prove that you have experience working on insurance projects for some.
Let's talk insurance well. Because that's your niche now. That's your area of expertise and your industry kind of target. At what point did you decide that was the way to go, and why insurance?
So I have been working. I've been a consultant almost all my life. And I have been working on insurance projects or with insurance customers on and off for the last 16, 17 years that I've been in this in technology. And the thing that I really find fascinating about insurance is how much they don't like adopting, or how slow they are in adopting new technology or platforms. I mean, there is a joke within the insurance circle where a big insurance company that has 50 policy admin systems says, oh no, we have 50 policy admin systems. Let's launch a transformation program and we'll just have one policy admin and replace all these 50 policy admin systems. And 2 years later, they now have 51 policy admin systems. And insurance is one of these companies where they still send data to each other using Excel sheets. You know, you have these, what they call as board row, which is a fancy term, I think, just for sending data in Excel spreadsheets to each other. There is no standardization in terms of data transfer. It's an industry that's dominated by intermediaries. So, and they don't have an incentive to standardize these interfaces, to standardize the implementation as well. So technology adoption is really quite disjointed. So there are some big insurance carriers, big brokers who have really good platforms, but you have a lot of these different insurance companies, brokers, MGAs, who still struggle with using the latest and the best. So the reason I decided to specialize in insurance is because it's unlike banking, which has a very high bar when it comes to technology. And, you know, they're always there. They're always looking at the next big thing. And banking, especially investment banking, they're already looking at quantum computers to solve their problems. Insurance is raw, and a lot of opportunities to solve problems within this industry. And I find it fascinating, the whole insurance chain. You know, when you're buying insurance, you're buying a promise that when something bad happens, they will compensate for it or take care of you. But then between you buying that insurance contract and the insurer, there's so many different things that happen that are invisible to you. So, you know, if you just go online and buy home insurance, you're probably buying that from a broker who's then buying that, who's then coordinating with an MGA, who's underwriting that policy from an insurer. That's all invisible to you. But these are the different things. And this is probably a very common thing in insurances. You have lots of intermediaries. And, you know, there is a opportunity to compact that value chain. Disintermediating is a bad term within the insurance industry because brokers have a lot of power. you have to make sure that you don't say, we'll build a technology that will just disintermediate the brokers. You can't do that, but you can compact the value chain for sure. I think brokers, as the technology evolves and there's more technology adoption and standardization, and I hope there will be, the role of a broker will change as well. They'll become more of risk specialists and advisors.
It sounds like it's going to be an even more interesting place to be in the future. But how do you stay on top of everything? Because you need to, I guess when you're positioning yourself as an industry expert, but also a platform expert, right? So you're going into these discussions as, I know your industry, but I also know Salesforce and the capabilities of the platform. How do you, because a lot of people out there are just focusing on, I need to learn Salesforce and be across as much as I can. How do you stay on top of both and spread your energy and efforts between the two?
So with platform, it's a straightforward answer, right? You do your trailheads and you follow the latest development within the platform. So with Salesforce, you just make sure that you know all about LWCs and not worrying about Aura components anymore. So that's an easy thing to do. With the industry expertise, it's difficult because you do need to be involved in projects to stay on top of the latest developments. But at the same time, it's good because especially for insurance, things are not evolving that fast. You know, the latest in insurance is we're talking about cyber insurance. Insurance industry has taken to DLT, which is based on the blockchain technology. So there are innovations happening within the insurance domain, but it's slow, and you know it's easy to keep track of that versus Salesforce launches something new tomorrow, or you know there's new within the JavaScript framework world that is more fast moving, and you have to stay on top of that. But it's also easy to track on the platform side. And the insurance side, as long as you're interested, as long as you're staying on top of these developments, again, there are blog posts, you follow the right people on Twitter and on LinkedIn, papers that you read to find out what's happening in terms of innovation, in terms of product offerings.
You've continually invested in education and initiatives outside of just Salesforce certifications. And so why is that important for you?
I think it's important because if you just super specialize in one thing, you're narrowing the surface area for opportunities. So when I decided that I wanted to specialize in insurance, I was thinking about the future, about cyber insurance. You know, that's going to be massive with the recent news of SolarWinds attack on the US government. You know, these attacks, the new warfare is in the cyber world, and people are taking cyber insurance very seriously, personal cyber insurance and commercial cyber insurance. So I looked at, okay, I'm good at Salesforce. I have a few certs. I have that expertise there. But I do also need to understand a bit more about cybersecurity. So I took a course from an online course from Stanford Engineering that allowed me to understand the different facets of cybersecurity that I need to think about. And hopefully I'll combine that knowledge with my knowledge of insurance. And, you know, at some point, if I do come across a cyber insurance project, I'll have the information and the expertise I need to make the right decisions and choices from a technology and platform point of view. So the reason I take these courses and the other course I took was from Said University from Oxford, which was around fintech. Is again, if you have this knowledge, and I'm not doing this just for the sake of getting these certifications and just to boast about it. It's more of a strategic thing for me to improve that surface area of opportunities. You know, so if I have more credibility and I know what I'm talking about, if I'm talking to the right people, because people won't take you seriously if you go to an industry and don't talk their language, especially in the insurance world, right? If you don't speak their language, then they won't take you seriously if you just speak your technology language, if in a way.
The key message, I think, is that you can't just say you're an industry expert, right?
No, yeah, exactly. You can't just say it's not like saying you're an architect and get away with it. You have to have that credibility and the knowledge and you need to know the different nuances of the processes involved within that industry and the different actors, different touch points, especially the customer touch points and the personas for that industry.
You can see disruption in the insurance industry. So what do you think, like 5 years down the line, what does the insurance industry look like from a Salesforce technology perspective, and how the platform is playing a role in the change that you see coming?
I think the Salesforce has a very good opportunity to help standardize some of these things that's holding the insurance industry behind. So one of the challenges that we have today is having a common set of standards to place an order, in a sense, right? And in simple terms, if you want to, for commercial insurance, if you want to place an order, today there are multiple systems involved. There's a lot of manual retyping of that same information in those multiple systems, multiple actors involved. There's a delay, you know, specifically when you're trying to do claims. So Salesforce has the opportunity to build solutions that industries can adopt. And I think, you know, if I'm being very bold, Salesforce can also lead the way in terms of providing guidance to define the standards that could help the industry move forward at a good pace. There are good initiatives out there, like Open Insurance Initiative, which is trying to help standardize some of these things. So Salesforce can look at those initiatives and either support them or adopt them or do whatever. But it's, you know, there's so many opportunities. It's still a very new industry to help grow. So 5 years from now, I hope the personal insurance in a way is more or less there. You know, you can go online and buy an insurance today for dental, home, and lots of other life insurance. The commercial insurance is where all the money is, though, because commercial insurance is complex. It's a lot of actors, a lot of data being transferred between one system to another. So standardizing that will be a bigger challenge. But once you solve one problem and set a pattern, then you can hopefully...
Is your view that we will need more industry specialists within the Salesforce ecosystem over the coming years, not just insurance, but do you see the role of a Salesforce professional kind of being more industry aligned?
I think so. I think, well, again, you know, forward-looking statement. I don't know what the higher-ups at Salesforce are thinking, but even if you don't consider that, there are many advantages of being an industry specialist. So you can be a generalist in technology, but having a specialism in one or two domains or industry is useful, because then you have the opportunity or credibility to apply for some senior roles. I mean, you know, you can only grow if your aspiration, and there's nothing wrong with the aspiration of, you know, being that next level up, even if you have CTA, you would hit that ceiling. So if you then want to grow beyond that, you know, if CTA is your goal, what's next after that? And in my view, what's next after that is specializing within an industry or something like that, that will give you the opportunity to traverse senior roles within a company. If you don't have that expertise, and if you just still kind of stay with CTA, then you'll just be CTA for years and years. And again, that's fine. You know, some people might enjoy that, and that's completely okay.
I think there's some really valuable gems in there for people at different stages of their journey, you know, maybe looking for a mentor or looking to transition into people management or go down the architecture path. But yeah, I think there'll be more industry specialists. And we do get a lot of clients reach out to us, and it's always been a thing around it. It would be nice if they have this industry experience, but I think that will become more of a, you know, a requirement where we need someone that understands what we're looking to achieve and hopefully has achieved it before in another company. So yeah, I think there's lots of value from people taking your journey on board and looking at ways they can do that in an industry, not necessarily just insurance.
Yeah, I think you know, a lot of these companies, what they're expecting is they want to hire someone who can hit the ground running, you know, because otherwise there is this lead time of training them up on all these different domain knowledge and all that stuff. But if you have someone who's an expert in banking but also knows Salesforce, it's much easier to sell that candidate or hire that candidate than someone who's probably has more experience in the technology but doesn't have that much experience with that within that domain. The other thing companies like candidates like this is because they know that these individuals have committed themselves to that specific domain. So they're more committed to solving the problems within the industry. All industries have problems. It's nothing specific to insurance or banking, or, you know, every industry wants to evolve, wants to grow. So these individuals will be considered favorably because they've been thinking about these problems, so trying to find solutions to these problems longer than someone who's just been focused on the platform side
sure.
of things.
I really enjoyed chatting. If anyone in our audience wants to reach out and pick your brains on anything, where's the best platform to find you?
Twitter. So I'm @Anoop on Twitter.
How did you get that name?
So yeah, feel free to hit me up on Twitter. I got that name just on Twitter when it was just 2 months old. So I think I found out about it on some website, a news website that I was reading. I was like, oh, there's this place where you can tell people what you're eating. You know, just it's like, oh, okay.
Yeah, nice. Well, thanks so much. Yeah, hopefully some of our audience will reach out to pick your brains on some of the topics we discussed.
Thanks, Ben. It was a pleasure. Take care.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Talent Hub Talk. If you're enjoying the podcast, we'd love it if you could subscribe and also leave a short review. We're keen for this podcast to reach as many people in the Salesforce ecosystem as possible, and your reviews will help us do that.